CliffCentral.com.
All right, all right, all right, all right. It is a Tuesday morning. It's the 14th of June on CliffCentral.com. Don't forget, we've got a public holiday this Thursday, so we will not be live. There will be no burning platform this coming Thursday, and Pumi and I will take the morning off, but the rest of the shows as usual. And, of course, Friday is not a public holiday, so people have to get back in and do the work. Sorry, I mean, what can I tell you? You got to work. You know, there's that song, isn't there? You got to work. Work. I can't remember how it goes. I'm going to embarrass myself by bringing it up now. We've got the author of this brilliant book coming up a little bit later. And I say brilliant book because it is actually kind of handy for anybody who wants to figure out how to deal with threats. It says, be the threat to your threats. In other words, preempt them. And Eric Kruger is someone we've had on the show before. He wrote a brilliant book, which I remember reading not so long ago. I'm going to go and try and find it and dust it off, about free speech and about how words are not violence. And I thought that was a really clever point that he was making there. And now he's making a point here about the threats. So we'll get to that a little bit later on with Eric Kruger. We don't hear from you in the comments, so let us know what you're up to this morning. You can drop us a message on YouTube or on Twitter, on Facebook, or on the emails. contact@cliffcentral.com. Let us know what you're up to this morning. Lebang is here with me, Lebang Hosana. I'm Gareth Cliff. It is your day. Let's see what you're up to. So, Lebang. Are you doing anything? You talked about Father's Day, but are you doing anything on this irritating, stupid public holiday because it falls on a Thursday? There's not really a lot you can do with that. I hate
these. Dude, I'd completely forgotten. I forgot that it's like Youth Day.
Well, these things matter. I mean,
and listen, it is.
It is Youth Day. Youth Day is obviously important, but what I'm saying is if a public holiday falls on a Tuesday or a Thursday or a Wednesday, Wednesday's the worst of all. Like, you can't really do anything with it unless you've taken off the Friday as well, in which case people know that you know, that's leave. That has to come off your leave. It doesn't strike me as a very useful thing to have a public holiday on a Tuesday, Thursday, or a Wednesday. It's like, we may as well just go to work. I think it's unproductive. It wastes everybody's time. Some people, of course, do not stop working, the essential service people.
Yeah.
And I love the idea of a holiday, don't get me wrong, but I just don't understand why we can't move every holiday in the year to the nearest Friday or Monday, just to make it simpler.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. But remember with Youth Day, like, there's a whole purpose behind it on paper. Theoretically, Youth Day is a day to remember what happened in 1976 and how the youth back then fought for us, et cetera,
yeah.
Which over the years, and I'm going to say it as bluntly as possible, it has not become about that at all.
Of course.
We literally just, it's just another day for us to not give a shit about stuff and continue on with our crappy lives. That's literally it. It's sad, but I did see somebody who proposed that we turn Youth Day into like a business building day where like, you know, small businesses get supported. Like, you strictly only support small, young, you know, people vibes. And that's it. Like, you just put your energy into promoting small businesses and supporting young people that are pushing entrepreneurship. And I thought that was pretty cool because that can actually give the day some substance. If anything, then you won't just find yourself waking up and just sleeping in and having another excuse to not do anything, you know. So if they can pull that off, that would be lovely.
No, I think that's a good idea. But, I mean, again, we could be doing that on a more permanent basis. I mean, if you know that there are two shops, right, let's say you've got a big supermarket that's run by a franchise store and your prices are maybe you save 2-3 cents on this and you save 5 cents on that if you go to them because they can do everything in volume. But there's a little corner shop that is run by a family, or maybe it's a little it's an operation that someone's just running from a caravan, frankly. And you can go and support them instead of buying, I don't know, something that you could buy at both, something where the quality is the same at both. And I know it's more effort for people because it means you have to stop somewhere else for one or two or three things. But yes, I think that's a good idea generally. If you could support the small businesses in this country, I think that's a really great idea. Of course, it's not always practical, but we should be doing that every day. I don't know why Youth Day has to be co-opted into that. It's a great idea, though. Don't get me wrong. I'm not criticizing it. I just think that we should be doing that every day. If you can support, you know, your local, whatever it is, barber, your local grocery store, your local butcher, baker, or whatever else it might be. Because there are these little stores that are popping up, which I love, that are, they're struggling, but they're coming along and they've got an idea. You know, someone wants to make cakes, for example. So they have a little cake store and they're trying to run it and they're trying to make money and they're trying to get people the best quality ingredients. They're trying to, it's almost a bit of a hobby. Maybe they're really into baking and this is their dream. They want to make a successful little outfit that they can eventually franchise to. I say support those people. They will put more love and care into everything they do than the big store, which is just really interested in how much they can shift every day in volume.
That's true.
It makes sense.
And it kind of just boils down to convenience, isn't it? That's like the big thing. That's where they get you, because it's more convenient to just, you know, take out your phone and like get your groceries delivered to you via an app or whatever the case is. But to really just apply yourself and say, you know what, let me actually go out of my way. Instead of buying bread here, let me go to the local bakery and get some cookies and blah, blah, blah. It's what you're saying. Let's try and work it into like our everyday lives. But if that convenience, it's tough. It is tough.
I want to call out someone in the comments here. This Adam Essence. This person is really pissing me off this morning. Look at you bringing down the message of Madiba. You disrespect Mandela. Commercialize the youth. Why don't you? Youth Day was his idea. Just go and listen to something else for this morning. We don't want you here anymore. Just piss off. Really. Honest to God. I'm just like so not interested in what you have to say this morning. You grumpy, angry piece of shit. Just go and find something else to listen to. Let's just give them a second.
Dude, people are grumpy and angry. Please don't doubt that. People are angry.
Wait, give them a moment to tune out. Okay, good. Adam Essence is gone. I've also put them in the timeout. So there we go. I mean, really, like, how could you have a problem with people supporting small businesses? How angry do you have to be?
I don't think Adam Essence listens to Dr. Hanan, because if he did, then he'd know. Like, dude, where you put your coins?
Spot on.
Perfect example.
Thank you.
Perfect example. So early in the day. I mean, come on.
Yeah. All right. Well, we do want to hear from anybody who has positive and useful and constructive ideas. We want to hear what your thoughts may be on spending that day. Because, again, you know, you could maybe take Father's Day and actually move it on to Thursday. Then you can, like, kill a bunch of birds with one stone. So you won't have to deal with all the Father's Day stuff that happens on the Sunday, which is going to mean more expensive, not as many bookings available if you want to take them out for lunch or whatever. You could do that on the Thursday. That's an idea. Yes, no?
Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't apply to everyone. Like, it sounds great. It does, trust me, I think on paper, yes, but I don't do it. It's not going to happen.
No.
That's the point.
Here's what's going to happen on my Thursday this week. I'm going to wake up late because that's still my favorite thing to do when I don't have to wake up early in the morning. I won't. That's my treat to myself. And I don't mean like 10, 11 o'clock in the morning. I just mean like an 8, 9 instead of a 5 a.m., you know? That would be nice. And then I'll probably just, I don't know, go around the house tidying things up, or I'll make myself a nice lunch, or maybe go to visit family. I'm not going to plan a whole bunch of stuff because I know what's going to happen. When Thursday rolls around, I'm going to be like, nah, I'm glad I didn't choose to do anything. I get the opposite of FOMO.
Yeah.
On days like that, I get the opposite of FOMO. I get jealous of people
who
didn't make plans.
I saw, Gareth, you did like a Q&A on your IG yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
Where like people could ask you a whole bunch of anonymous questions. I was literally canning myself. I think there's like something in the ether trying to get you to either go on a date.
I know.
Get laid or hook up. I don't know. But a lot of the questions were like, would you go out with somebody like this, that? I think maybe
I knew,
we should sit you up here.
You know what? I knew when I said I was going to do it, because I was sitting there watching I was watching some series that I've tried to get in, Moon Knight, okay, which I'm trying to watch. And I watched two episodes of it. I don't know if I'm into it yet or not. But while I was sitting there watching them, I was like, all right, this is not entertaining me. Let me get onto Instagram. And I saw a bunch of other people had done this anonymous question thing, which was hilarious. And I knew when I said you can ask anonymous questions, you know what people are like. They immediately go for like relationship stuff or like all the controversial things like what is your point of view about vaccines or any of that stuff. I knew that was going to happen.
Yeah.
But I thought, what the hell? Let's go. I'm not afraid of this stuff. I've got nothing to hide. Let's answer some questions. And if they come from anonymous people, then people can be more honest because they're not worried that I'm going to like retaliate against them. I don't know how that would be possible, but people worry about that. They don't like to say or ask or think the things that they're really thinking in public. They want to be anonymous. But it was fun.
It's easier to ask those things when you're anonymous, isn't it? Because then your name's not attached to it. You can be the purest form of douchebag that you've always wanted. Who you really want to be, you can be because it's anonymous. Some of those questions were just bizarre. I was just like, wowza. But I do think it's time to go on a bit of a date or something.
Yeah.
The people want that for you.
But you know, again, Some people really just, I don't know if they were raised differently to me or they have a different point of view about what happiness is like or what it means to be a well-balanced individual. And maybe I'm the wrong one. Maybe they're the wrong one. I don't know. But the fact is, some people just they are incapable of seeing single people as being happy. And this is... It's just something I've never really understood. I don't care to explain myself to people who feel differently to me on this because really you've got to do what makes you happy. So if being in a relationship or even an unhappy relationship, which is the case for so many people, if that's what you're after, go for it. You know, I don't come around to your door and go, why are you in a relationship? Excuse me, why are you in a relationship? You should get out of this relationship. It's deeply unhappy. All you and your husband or wife do is fight all day long. All you do is complain and bicker about the kids and the bills and everything else. I think you should get out of this relationship. Can you imagine if single people went around doing that to people in relationships? We'd be burned at the stake.
No, definitely. I kind of blame society and media. Media has painted happiness to equal being with another person. You cannot be alone and be happy according to society, which is total bullshit. Because you end up, like you're saying, just being completely miserable. When you think of single people, you just think lonely and sad and not having a life, blah, 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 which really isn't the case. If we can just change the mindset of what happiness really is for people, then I think a lot more people will be happy. You can't place your happiness in another person because when you don't find that person, then what's the automatic, you know, go-to? It's, well, I guess I'm not happy, which shouldn't be the case. But anybody listening, if you can hook Gareth up with anybody that I think will be intellectually challenging and entertaining, please send an email to contact at cliffcentral.com.
The number of times I've had people say to me, oh, I know the perfect girl. You've got to be with this girl. Let me introduce you. And it's just always a mess when you do that. I don't believe in, you know, the Jews call it a shidduch. It's where you put together two people you think would get along well and you kind of hope they get along well. I did that not so long ago. I don't know whether it worked or not, but so it was this guy friend of mine and this girl that I've known for a long time. And I arranged for them to both join us for dinner. There were about four or five of us. I can't remember. And then they hit it off really well. And I thought, yes, this is good. You know, I feel like Cupid. I've put these people together. And she did end up going home with him. And I think he made her breakfast the next morning, which is a good sign. But I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened after that, because neither of them are telling me, and I'm not going to ask. It's none of my business. So I'm.
Cupid, you definitely need to ask. You need to find out hard work.
No, that's the problem. Is it's not about me. So the right thing to do is to leave them. Now you've put them together, you've introduced them to each other, they may be compatible, who knows? If they're not going to volunteer information, I'm not going to go digging around. It's none of my business. So honestly, I've done all I could. If it makes them happy, great. If they ended up only having a one-night stand or even less than that, that's also fine. I did what I could. Now I'm moving on. So I don't even have... I'm not even curious. I'm not even curious about whether or not they hit it off.
The problem is if they didn't hit it off, then you're somehow to blame, right? It's like, if Gareth didn't, you're actually choosing the safer bet.
Only if you ask. So you don't have to ask. I don't get involved in other people's relationships. I really don't. Carol says, Gareth, I'm with you. There's so many unhappy marriages. Well, yeah, but there are lots of happy people in relationships. So because we see it from our point of view, like let's say you're the kind of person who doesn't believe in relationships. There are those people. Then you will find stories to back up your side of the argument. You'll find all the unhappy relationships and you'll say, oh, look at those people. Look how miserable they are. And because they're miserable, that means relationships are bad for you, which is nonsense, obviously. Donna says, I don't need
to make yourself feel better.
Yeah, correct. Donna says, I don't need another person to validate my happiness. Totally content in my own life. You can't make another person happy. Far from lonely because my life is so full and I'm so satisfied. Yeah.
I love that. I love that.
You're lucky, Donna. I mean, not everybody's like that. And, you know, some people would say you protest too much when you say something like that. But you're the only one who knows. How does some stranger, this is what I've always found so bizarre. How does a complete stranger believe in their wildest dreams that they know you better than you? Isn't that the most arrogant thing you've ever heard? I mean, Lebang, it's like people saying to you, ah, Lebang, I don't know how you can have 5 children. That's just impossible. Like, how can you possibly be happy? And why would you do that with your life? You know? It's arrogant.
So many people don't know themselves, though, Gareth. That we need to be honest about. We're kind of lucky that we, you know, we know who we are. We're on this journey of, like, discovering ourselves every day. So we're quite aware, self-aware. But a lot of people are just kind of flying around, dude, just keeping it moving, just winging every single part of life to the point where they don't even know who the fuck they are. And that's why they feel entitled to judge other people and be like, eh, but how could you put your foot? Because, bro, when you look in the mirror, you're just like...
It's not even judging. It's like they know your innermost thoughts better than you do. They'll be your shrink. They've spent exactly 2 seconds thinking about you. Like in the case, maybe you heard Donna's comments there and you're listening to what Donna had to say about how she doesn't need another person, blah, blah, blah. And there will be somebody who's listening to those words that are from Donna. She's the boss of her own head and her own heart. She knows what's going on in her life. Someone will read that and go, no, Donna's just fooling herself. You're like, hang on a second. What, do you have a magic machine that you can read people's minds better than they can? You sometimes figure out, like, stuff before they even know it about themselves? Wow, you must be so powerful. You must be able to do...
Teach us, sensei.
You must be able to pick the lotto numbers every week. That's clearly, you're the most successful, brilliant person in the world. You could read everyone's minds. How lucky you are to be you. You know, meanwhile...
Yeah, no, it doesn't work like that.
Meanwhile, all that person is doing is they're just projecting. And it's very... I mean, listen, again, to go back to those questions that I did last night on Instagram, to me it was just a hilarious, entertaining waste of time and an opportunity to engage with people and to have some fun. I mean, I don't think I answered any of it very seriously. Most of it was ridiculous. And that's how I approach a lot of things in life, especially the stuff that's emotional that everybody else gets really hit up about. Like, if you took it less seriously, maybe you'd be happier. Don't you think?
Exactly. No, definitely. I agree with you. But who are you going to tell to take things less seriously when the petrol price is the way that it is, when the cost of living is going up every 2 days? Bread used to be 20 rand, now it's 40 rand. Our heads are just wrapped around those sorts of things. You know, we're putting our coins in really the things that we shouldn't. We shouldn't be, you know, focusing on the things that we can't control. Gareth, before we talk to Eric, it's Ndokozo's birthday.
Oh,
right now,
Ndokozo. Very good.
Yeah, we've got a birthday happening in the family.
All right, very good. Nice. And that's also why you're still in bed this morning. Nice. Ndokozo's taking it slow today. That's very cool. In every moment, we are relating to something or someone, or not relating, if that be the case. How we relate to the smallest thing in life is how we relate to everything, no matter what our mask is. That's high philosophy for this time in the morning, parallel parking.
Parallel parking, is that you?
I don't know. I don't know if that made any sense at all, whether that is profound or whether it's just bullshit. I can't tell you. I don't know.
Hey, look, it sounds smart, okay?
Yeah. Everyone who is concerned with another person's way of life is low-key concerned about their own. That's true. So even though parallel parking may have made the most incredible comment ever, maybe it's the most profound thing ever said on the show, I'm going to say that Sanele's, I can understand what Sanele's saying better. So I'm going to go with Sanele's comment here. Everyone is concerned about another person's way of life is low-key concerned about everything in their own. Yeah. You have to also, and maybe this is something we'll talk to Eric about just now. Maybe you have to take risks and you have to be willing to put yourself out there in order to succeed. You know, if you don't take a chance, if you don't face your fears, I mean, the book is called Dangerous, Be the Threat to Your Threats. This is Eric's new book. Maybe that's something we could talk to him about just now. I think that's very cool. That's an interesting comment to make and an interesting thought to have. Is there anything you're really afraid of, Lebang? Is there anything that you're absolutely terrified of doing for yourself? I mean, not with respect to your kids or your job or your relationship or any of that stuff, but just in terms of your own life, is there stuff that you've just avoided that you don't want to do?
I mean, definitely stuff that I've avoided, and this is going to sound very, very cheesy, but I've always felt like I'm supposed to be doing so much more, but I'm always holding back from, like, reaching that next step.
Right.
And I don't know what it is. Like, it's like low-key imposter syndrome mixed with, oh, no, what are people going to say? And, you know, am I worthy of really taking it to the top? So I always find myself just, like, operating in, like, this zone, just like a mid, like, okay, cool, I wake up, I do this, I do that. But I just know that there's something that I'm supposed to do. I just don't know what it is yet. But whatever it is, I am guck scared of it because it's going to take a whole lot more discipline. It's going to take so many sacrifices. And I'm stalling. That's the truth. I'm stalling.
You're comfort zoning it up. That's what you're doing.
Bro, it's I just feel like the clock is ticking. But eventually it'll hit me in the face and I'll just have to just stop and be like, fuck, okay, fine. Let me just get to it.
Do it.
Whatever it is. Look, but I've just always felt that there's just, yeah, there's a thing.
It is the case. It is the case for you that you have a very full plate right at the moment. You've got a lot going on. So
100%.
I'm not going to make excuses for you, but I do think that that's worth throwing into the mix. All right. I mean, listen, who isn't trying to chase down some goals? This Tuesday morning. So let's talk to Eric Kruger. I'm very excited to have him on. He's written a new book called Dangerous, Be the Threat to Your Threats. Hey, Eric, how are you?
Hey, Gareth, good on you.
Good to see you, man. Lebang and I were just talking about your book, and we were talking about how, you know, people get stuck and they sometimes are so afraid of something. They're so scared of the worst case scenario happening. They're so afraid that all the threats will come descending down on them at once and their whole life will be ruined. I wonder how many people are paralyzed by that. Is that part of the reason you wrote this book?
For sure. I think what ends up happening is that we get stuck in survival mode without even realizing that we are in survival mode. And we start slotting into this pattern of thinking, feeling, and acting that we just repeat day in and day out. And it becomes our way of life. It becomes our way of doing. And we feel like we're living optimally. We feel like we are doing okay in life. But in reality, if you had to zoom in and really inspect what's happening for yourself, you'll find that you are in survival mode. And so, I mean, we've all experienced that over the past few years in spades.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And it's not a great place to be. We want to, like, no one wants to be in survival mode.
Well, let me give you a proper intro so that people know who you are. I mean, I've spoken to you before on the show, but it's good to have you back. You're an international speaker, executive coach, and author. Your book, Dangerous, is an invitation to step out of the survival mode you've just been talking about and become a more formidable version of yourself. In Dangerous, which, by the way, you can get in printed and digital format, Eric explains the difference between those who are dangerous and those who are not, how it happens that we become harmless, ineffective against the threats that we're facing, ending up in survival mode, withdrawn and fragile. He explains the three different states that you could be existing in at any point in time, being harmless, being dangerous, or being reckless. And the best place to be, according to you, is dangerous, right?
For sure.
All right, so explain the difference between it. Why is being harmless a bad place to be? A lot of people in society these days will say, oh, you know, that person, they're so sweet. No one ever says anything horrible about them. They just, everybody loves them. but they're harmless. Why is that actually why is that an insult and not a compliment?
Doesn't that make you cringe just hearing that?
Oh, listen, if someone called me harmless, I'd be running and hiding. But I think Lebang, you feel the same way, right? Someone said,
totally.
At Lebang, she's so harmless. So why do you think harmless?
She can kill a fly.
Why do you think harmless is such a problem?
You know, that's a big part of the book is just the language that I'm using around harmless and dangerous, because I want people to kind of feel shocked by it in a way. I want it to be slightly provocative in that sense, because when you hear that you are harmless, it should really not make you feel good about yourself.
No.
But if I go back to where it started in 2019, pre-pandemic times, I was working with this coaching client of mine, mm-hmm. successful CEO, runs a company of about 600, 700 people. And it was this weird moment where everything in his life was going well. He was mentally in a good state. He was physically in a good state. His teams were doing well. His family life was good. But yet when I was speaking to him, it was like he was stuck in survival mode. And it was this weird paradox. Everything going well, mentally in survival mode.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're in survival mode, you always see these sort of three things happening. You are very reactive to what's happening around you. You are just trying to get through the day. You are operating from fear, frustration, and anxiety, which leads to these two distortions, the distortion of severity and the distortion of probability. Distortion of probability says things are likely to go wrong, and distortion of severity says that when it goes wrong, it's going to be catastrophic.
Yeah.
And so you're kind of always overthinking. The moment you stop being reactive, your hands go idle, your mind fires up, and you just start overthinking everything.
Right.
And then the third thing that happens is that what you do in survival mode keeps you in survival mode. And that's exactly because you create this pattern of thinking, feeling, and acting that you just perpetuate the entire time. And so I was looking at him, and I was like, well, obviously you are stuck in survival mode. You're experiencing many of these things. You're waking up in the morning without excitement, enthusiasm for the day. So, like, something's off. But there has to have been something that led you to being in survival mode. That's the end point where you find yourself. Mm. And I thought about it a lot, right? And, like, the one day I just realized that when I looked at him, he was harmless. Like, there was just nothing to him anymore. Like, he wasn't formidable. He wasn't, what you were saying earlier, he wasn't taking risk. He wasn't growing. I was just like, you're like a shadow of your former self. Like, where's the person that was so ambitious and so driven that got you to where you are today?
Yeah.
You're harmless. And so we spoke about it for the rest of the session. And then towards the end of the session, I said to him, well, you know, if you're not going to be harmless, then what will you be? And he said, dangerous. And the moment he said that, I was like, of course, like, yes, like, I also want to be dangerous. And that's kind of what set me off on the path to figure out what it means.
My experience in business has been that the people who are most exciting to be around are the ones who are a little bit dangerous. They're the ones who take the risks. They're the ones that make an unpopular decision because they don't really give a shit what other people think. They're not just satisfied with what's going on right now and trying to keep it the same or trying to keep it going. They want more. And then you've got to, like, counterbalance this harmless part with what you said in that part I just read, that quote I just took from there. You don't want to go so far into dangerous that you go beyond it and become reckless, right? Because that's on the opposite extreme. So explain what the reckless part is and how that came to be in your writing.
Yeah, so when I talk about being dangerous, what does it mean? It means that you cultivate a certain pattern of thinking, feeling, and acting that empowers you to overcome the threats in your life, because we all have these threats that we have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And how you respond to these threats then matter. And as you just discussed, there will be times when you will respond to these threats in an ineffective way. And when you do that, you are harmless and you end up in survival mode. But there's also another way that we respond, which is ineffective, which is that we are reckless. And what does that mean? It means that we literally put ourselves or others in harm's way. It means that we squander resources. And I think ultimately it's taking risk without considering the real consequences of that risk. Because when we talk about being dangerous and you having to take some risk, I think that's always backed up by a certain level of confidence, of knowing that you have the skill to execute on what you need to execute on. It's actually funny because I was thinking about it this morning, just before jumping on the show, and I thought, like, reckless is knowing that there are many things to fix in a country, but spending it on a flag, for example, right? So like, that's a good way of describing it.
All right.
But it's squandering resources. It's
more than that. If people are reckless, yeah. Like let's say you're reckless in terms of your health and you take a whole bunch of drugs and you don't do any physical exercise and you drive fast on the highway late at night, those are reckless, obviously reckless decisions. In respect of your relationship, a lot of people are reckless with their relationships because they are so bored inside of them. We were just talking about this a couple of minutes before you came on. That they will do anything to feel that spark of excitement and danger and the thrill, you know, the thrill of being caught, that they'll go and cheat on their spouse or whatever. That's reckless. And then in terms of finances, it could be really reckless of you to go and take all of your company's profits and buy Bitcoin. And that's not a very sensible idea, no matter how much you believe in Bitcoin, right?
And at the same time, then that's why the two are so linked, because the moment you are reckless, you are also actually harmless against that threat. Because now what you're doing is that you're taking your company's profits, investing in Bitcoin, losing all of that, which means that you don't have enough resources to fund your team, to fund resource and development, whatever it may be. So in a way, by you being reckless, you are also harmless. Those two are very closely linked.
All right, so Lebang, you must obviously have some questions about this too, but I just want to ask quickly, how do you know where those boundaries are? Because the worst thing you can do is think that you're being dangerous, but you're actually being reckless, or think you're being harmless, but you're nowhere near there yet. Maybe you're too much into the harmless, and you're not approaching dangerous properly enough. Because it's not black and white, it's gray areas, right?
For sure. Everything is nuance. But I think the most important thing that you can do is to step away, because unfortunately most of us don't really have the self-awareness to know how we are showing up. And in my experience, survival mode is invisible, which means that being reckless will also become invisible to you because it's just your default way of operating. And I'll keep coming back to the fact that we cultivate certain patterns, routines, rituals in our lives, and when these things have become deeply ingrained, we stop seeing them. So the only way that you really get to see those patterns is that you stop for long enough to create a bit of time to think about it, and perhaps even use an external resource like a friend or a partner or a coach to help you see what those patterns are. And once you can see them, then you can change them. Like, it's very difficult to change what we can't see.
Yeah, that's not exactly the answer I was looking for. I was hoping you'd give me I was hoping you'd give me a lot more definitive descriptions of where that line between these three categories is. But maybe we must move on from that. There's a lot more in the book than just this discussion.
It seems like it doesn't exist, Gareth. To be honest, like it's so much of an overlapping environment, like the concepts even. It's just like, as you said, there's no, you know, this is what I'm doing, this is not what I'm not doing. But Eric, like practically, we do really fall into these patterns, dude. It's easy for us to wake up, eat, go to work, come back, kiss the kids, go to sleep, wake up, do that over and over again. How do we stop ourselves from getting to that point where now we're too comfortable, we're not dangerous enough, we're not taking risks, we're doing absolutely nothing, and we're starting to feel hollow in essence, and too robotic? So, because I know that when, for example, something's wrong, you first have to identify that something's wrong. How do we as people stop just before the point where it's like, oh, something is up? And in a more practical sense, because it's difficult to know when you are and when you aren't. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Ultimately, it comes down to how do you cultivate that self-awareness? How do you zoom out a little bit, right? There are many different tools that we can create for self-awareness. I think we have tools like journaling. We have tools like meditation. Like, I'm a big fan, for example, of having some, like, once you've identified your pattern and you've identified the thing that you want to break about that pattern. So let's say, for example, you want to start exercising. Let's use this as like a very easy example. You want to start exercising, you haven't been doing that, that's the pattern that you want to break. The easiest way for you to create awareness around that is that every day at the end of the day, you have a reflection around, did I go and exercise or not? And what was the reason? What might have gotten in the way? And the more you can identify the things that are getting in the way, the more you can hopefully remove them and start creating some consistency in how you are training. But, you know, there's research that shows that only 15% of people are really, truly self-aware. And that's a shockingly low number. And I totally get it. Like, it makes, wow, makes complete sense to me. And again, the problem is that we don't see those patterns. But when you have those tools where you can slow down and think about what's happening in your life, I think that provides you some perspective. Having other people to work with gives you some perspective. But unfortunately, Garrett, to come back to your point, like, I don't think there aren't clear boundaries. That's why everything is around nuance, like that fingertip feel around, am I pushing too far? Do I need to pull back a bit? Am I being too harmless? Do I need to ramp things up a bit?
And it depends on where you are in life, too. For a lot of people, a little bit more harmlessness is not a bad idea. Like, if you've got, you know, responsibilities and two toddlers in the house, or you've got a very fragile business that maybe you've just started, there are certain things you need to apply the brakes on and be more judicious about than if you were just, you know, throwing away. Let's say you're Elon Musk and you've got billions in the bank and you've got 17 successful companies and now you want to build a rocket. Some people would say that's reckless or even dangerous. I think it's more dangerous than it is reckless, and in a good way. But maybe maybe you don't have to be as harmless because you've got less to lose. I mean, a lot of people, again, I just want to draw the distinction here because I think this is important too. And you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, Eric. But survival mode to me is the situation most people are in because they can't think beyond that stuff. They're actually looking for a meal. They're looking for a warm place to sleep. They're looking for someone who can just validate them.
Yeah.
You know, and that stuff is so basic. That's so, we're not looking to, you talk about, you know, being self-actualized or being self-aware. I mean, those are just on Maslow's hierarchy. Survival mode is that bottom level of the pyramid. And a lot of people are just, they don't have enough money to make it through the day. Their health is failing them. Their relationships are all just absolute turmoil, maybe even abuse. Those people can't get out of survival mode because survival, in order for those things to be ticked off on the list and for you to get to the next level, you need to actually find a level of comfort. You need to find a level of like happiness and general health. And for some people, that's just so out of the question. So we're talking now, and I think you and your book are largely talking about people who aren't in the desperate throes of survival, who aren't like trying to just make it through the day and eke out an existence and, you know, put bread on the table. You're talking to people who I think largely are the people who listen to this show. And lucky us, you know, that all of us can have these questions about self-awareness and achieving our goals and all of that stuff, because that's a couple of steps up from survival mode. Am I wrong?
Definitely. No, I think you are spot on. This book was written essentially, I mean, the premise came out of a coaching session with an executive who does very well for himself. So that's kind of where it was born.
Yeah.
And it definitely, when I look at people who are very, very deep in survival mode, the way that you were describing it now, I think we have to remember that survival mode serves a purpose as well. Like, it exists for a reason, because it helps us to survive. And when you are like very deep in survival mode, and to your point, like, you just need to get the next meal onto the table, find a like warm place to sleep, then survival mode is probably going to serve you well in helping you to maintain life.
Mm-hmm.
But for the rest of us, I think there are times we slip into survival mode and it's okay to be there. It's just not okay to stay there. We have the means to change that situation, and we have to do it. And I think very often, if we look at people in that, at that level, what we find is that they learn to become helpless. Like, so there's this great term called learned helplessness, which just says that when we find ourselves in a situation where we feel defanged and declawed, we feel like we don't have agency to change the situation, then we learn to become helpless. And I remember, so like many years ago, 2007, I graduated as a physiotherapist, and I have many memories from my times in working in the hospitals. But the one was walking into a room with our supervisor, and we were looking at this patient who had a knee replacement, and there was a nurse next to him feeding him, And the supervisor like freaked out. She was like, what are you doing? Like you, like this guy had a knee replacement. His hands are working perfectly fine. And what she was trying to get at is that we coddle people very often. Like when they are trying to recover from an injury, we coddle them and we think we're being kind to them, but actually you're doing them a disservice. They need to struggle a bit. They need to like feed themselves. They need to, like, if a spoon drops onto the floor, figure out how to get to it. Because then it reminds them that they have the power to do these things. And I think that's often been one of the biggest things that the book has allowed or given to people, is that it's reminded them that you don't have to be in survival mode. You don't have to be harmless. There is another option. And that option is that you get to be a threat to the threat, that you can be dangerous again, because we've often experienced what it feels like to be dangerous, like to feel like I'm on the front foot, things are going well, I'm moving forward, and then we lose it. And hopefully a book like this comes along and reminds you that you can be dangerous again and creates that desire for you again.
All right, I want to take a quote from the book and we move on to this, because you say one of the greatest weapons that you have is your ability to reason, to size up the opponent, and then to devise a plan that will move you forward towards victory. However, it's easy for us to miscalculate the odds and misinterpret the severity of a threat, or to get fixated on the wrong plan. So let's just look at that for a second. The idea that you should move towards victory. There seems to be this idea, and it's largely something that's cropped up in the last 20, maybe 30 years, of participation trophies, of everyone's a winner, of as long as you do the best for you, that you're going to be fine. As long as you live your true, authentic self, your best life, everything will be okay. That's not really how the world works. There are winners and losers. And reason, and any cursory study of history will teach you that if you decide you're going to be a winner, very often you will be a winner. If you're more concerned with just keeping up with everyone else, or if you think that it doesn't really matter whether or not you are objectively successful, you're never going to have that success. There's going to be a huge hole in your soul. And for a lot of people, this is a tough thing to come to terms with, because, you know, your parents may have been telling you, no, as long as you do your best, that's fine, which it isn't, because someone is going to be better and they will beat you. Mm. Maybe it was Oprah Winfrey for all those years. She was on TV. Dr. Phil for all those years. He's been on TV. Maybe it's psychologists and psychiatrists and therapists all over the place who are telling people, as long as you are true to yourself, everything will be fine. That's not true, though, Eric. You have to win.
I agree. I think there are ways that we think the world works, and then there are ways that the world actually works. And at the end of the day, there are always going to be people who win, and there's always going to be a second place and a third place and a fourth place and a last place. Mm-hmm. And you have to decide where you want to rank. And, you know, it's interesting, because in coaching, often I'll see people come in and they're like, well, do I need to have goals to work towards? And I'm like, well, that's an interesting question. Like, what would be the alternative? And then they'll say, well, the alternative is that I want to just be 1% better every single day. And I go, okay, well, I get that. Like, I think that's okay. But 1% better for what? Like, so, like, what is the aim here? Mm. Well, no, because I do want to be, like, a better leader. So I'm like, well, actually, you do have a goal. And the reason that they don't want to actually articulate or verbalize the goal is because they have this big inherent fear that the moment they put it into words and it becomes a reality, that they might fail and not get there.
Also, then they have to hold themselves to account. And some people are people are so uncomfortable with being measured, right? This is why we have, you know, people who say, oh, well, your tests that you do at school don't really matter. And don't weigh yourself after you've been trying to lose weight for a week. Rather just kind of feel whether or not you're feeling better, which is such horseshit. Mm. Like, you actually have to have objective ways of measuring this stuff.
And one of the best feelings, ultimately, is like when you feel effective.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen this when, again, like from the book, from coaching, the word that pops up so often is like, I just want to be effective. Because when we feel effective, we also feel like we are doing meaningful things. We feel like we are progressing towards something. And that it makes us feel accomplished. And like just participating, I don't think makes you feel accomplished.
Yeah, well, Goldishek says here, if you're told that you're amazing your whole life, what are you actually working towards? In your eyes, you're already there. Do you think that we're do you think that we're too coddled as a society these days? Maybe my generation, maybe the next one. Do you think we're too soft and that we've become complacent and we get told, oh, no, you're amazing, when the only amazing thing you do is get up and go and do your average job every day? You know, your grandfather was going to war at 18. and didn't know whether he'd make it through the day. I mean, is the modern world too soft on people? Is that why there's so many people who are feeling hopeless, that are depressed, that are feeling suicidal? Is it because they don't have enough purpose in their life and they don't feel like they're achieving anything?
I agree with you that, you know, one of the threats I actually speak about in the book is the threat of complacency, because complacency does dull your skill. It takes away your wits and your sharpness. So I think complacency is a big thing. And I think that's also why we end up seeing so many challenges these days that are actually designed, like there's that one from Andy Priscilla called 75 Hard. And the idea is actually to make yourself as uncomfortable for 75 days by doing, I think it's something like you have to read X amount of time every single day. You have to do 2 workouts every day. One of them has to be work outside. But it's like this list of things all designed to make you uncomfortable, because we just realize that, again, this pattern that we slot into every single day is comfortable. And we want it that way. We want to enjoy, and I mean, we could argue even like the remote working boom that we've seen, the comfort that people have experienced with that is driving that even more.
Yep.
You know, like before we were all okay going to the office to a certain extent. Now that we've experienced the comfort of working from home, we all want to work from home. The question is, does that work in the long run? Who knows?
Okay, so I'm going to ask you another question based on a quote from the book. The safe option, and most people take a safe option in every given scenario. I mean, you know, we all think we're risk takers, but really we're not. I mean, like a lot of people are just always choosing the safer option, and that is to retreat when danger comes at you, right? So why move forward at all, you say? Why summon the courage to face the threat? It's because the threat guards something that the hero wants. It's the dragon, right? It can take many forms. It could be the lover that must be saved, the world that must be protected, the treasure that must be seized. But people don't. They think that they're a fighter. You know, you're told, oh no, I'm a brave, authentic human being. And again, this is the propaganda that's put out there in the media, and this is what people are told in all kinds of ways. The reality is, this is not what people do. They retreat. They run like little scared babies the minute anything difficult comes along.
Yeah. So the part that you're referencing is in reference to the hero's journey, which is something that's written by Joseph Campbell. He wrote in The Hero of 1,000 Faces. Do you guys know it? Have you heard of The Hero's Journey?
Yeah.
You know it? Okay. So, so for the listeners then, a quick bit of context. So The Hero's Journey is the 17-step process that he outlined that says that every hero goes on this journey, and they go through these very specific phases at different times. I won't take you to all of them, but what we always find is we find the hero in the known world, meaning that we find them where they are comfortable, where they've always been, where there's nothing special about them. We find Frodo in the Shire, Harry Potter under the stairs at his uncle's house. We find Diana in Themyscira, her homeland, right? And then there's always this call to adventure that says you have to go and do something.
Right.
And often the hero will refuse the call. They'll feel they won't have what it takes. But eventually what's true for all heroes' journeys is that they leave, is that they move from the known world into the unknown, meaning they go from what is comfortable, what is certain, to what is unknown and what is uncertain. And then along the way, they encounter villains, they encounter mentors, friends, obstacles, challenges, but everything is building up to this one moment, and that moment is where they're going to face the monster, the threat, the danger. And what we then realize is that, and this was quite a solidifying moment for me in terms of this idea, which is that if the hero is going to overcome the monster, the threat, the danger, and get to the other side, which is there's always a good reason to get to the other side, as the quote was saying, there's the love to be saved, there's the treasure to be found, but most importantly, actually, there's personal transformation on the other side, is that if you are going to overcome the monster, the threat, the danger, then you have to be a threat to the threat and a danger to the danger. Because if you can't do that, if you are harmless and you don't have what it takes, then you lose every single time. And so it's important, because we realize then that as we go through the process of becoming a threat to the threat and a danger to the danger, that's actually the most direct route to personal transformation, to us learning more about ourselves and becoming the better version of us that we can uncover, that we can become.
Yeah, another thing you've said is that we wait for things to break before we do something. We wait for it to get really, really bad. We're not good at being proactive. Again, people believe, they tell themselves the lie that no, as soon as I feel that things aren't going well, I'll do something about it. They don't. We slowly become more and more used to levels of discomfort, levels of dis-ease, levels of tolerance for things that are not meant to be happening. And we don't make those decisions quickly enough. You know, a relationship might be falling apart and we just do nothing. We sit there and go, oh, well, it'll figure itself out. It never does. Is that right?
Yeah. And the small threats become the big threats. You know, those small threats that you see every single day and you're like, oh, well, I had this pain in my chest, but I'll get to it later. Or like things in my relationship aren't great, but I'll get to it later. Like in the moment, they are small threats, but those small threats left undealt with become the big threats.
Yeah.
Again, back to like my hospital days, we'd often see patients come in and they had osteoarthritis in both hips because that's how our OA presents itself. And then the one hip would be really bad and they'd get the hip replacement on that side. And the doctor would say to them, listen, we've done this hip. It's going to take 12 weeks of rehab or so. Once you're done, like maybe a year from now or so, come back and let's do the other hip now, because if you leave it, over time, it's going to get worse.
Right.
It's going to weaken. You might just fall one day. It might just spontaneously snap one day. But it might take another 5 or 10 years. And by that time, you're older, you're more at risk for surgery. So come back in a year and let's just do it.
Mm-hmm.
Almost no one comes back.
No.
Right? Because it feels okay. And so what happens is that it snaps, because it will snap 10 years later, and then they have to suffer through it, and they're much older, much more fragile. It's going to be much harder to recover.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to have those catalytic moments where things fall apart, and then we can say, well, now we're ready to start rebuilding. It's an unfortunate part of the human condition, I think.
Yeah, why do you think we are like that? Why do you think we're so so easily we fall into like this? It's, I suppose, the same thing we talk about every morning, Lebang. You know, no one wants to wake up at 5 o'clock. It never feels good. You never go, oh, yay, 5 o'clock. We seem to have this idea in our heads that other people are more morning people than we are. But actually, no one on earth likes a cold shower. No one on earth likes to wake up at 5 a.m. No one on earth likes to go for a run. No one, not even the people who like running. They only like the way they feel after the run. That's how they get through it. Is that about right, Eric? I mean, like we also expect instant gratification these days, right? There's no delayed gratification. We're not good at putting out present me in order to make future me better.
Mm. Living an intentional life is a very difficult thing to do, because there are just so many things that are vying for our attention all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like even if you're not if you're not feeling like you're in survival mode, our default response to the world still becomes that I'm reactive all the time. And so that's kind of how I navigate through my days. I'll just see what pops up and I'll, whatever demands my attention, I'll give my attention to that.
Yeah.
And attention has become really like the most important resource that you have. And so being the intentional custodian of that attention becomes the most important job. And your attention then needs to be on, well, how do I become the kind of person that I want to be? How do I craft the kind of life that I want to craft? And what you'll often find is that if you want to seize those big opportunities, they're always going to go hand in hand with certain threats. This is one of the things that I think goal setting misses out on in such a dramatic way, is that we think our goals are going to be a straight line. Like when we set a SMART goal, specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, time-bound, they all speak about the way to get there, but they don't speak about the things that might get in the way of you getting there. And I can't see how we can actually do that. Like if we set a goal, there needs to be the part that says, what will get in the way? What is the threat of me not getting there? And then how will I be the threat to that threat? But doing that every single day, that bringing that level of attention and intention to your life is quite demanding. And it's just so much easier to switch back to autopilot and let that take care of how things unfold.
Yeah, I say this almost every day. Just switch off your notifications on your phone, on your computer. Switch them off and be in control of what you consume and what you're exposed to. It really does make a difference. I think that falls a little bit into the living intentionally and you being in charge of the kind of life that you ultimately live. And Gareth laughs all the time, but it's such a big game changer.
And Eric, I mean, going with that, because Lebang is right, we are so dependent on other people's approval in society these days that we forget that we need our own approval. And you know, because you can feel it inside when you're doing something that you're meant to be doing. It just energizes you and makes you more enthusiastic and seems to propel you forward and sometimes makes you dangerous in a really good way. When you're doing things to please other people the whole time, and that's not to say that there isn't value in pleasing other people. You know, teamwork is hugely important. Taking people with you is a massive part of what we all have to do. And you cannot do everything on your own. But seeking the approval of strangers is about the most pointless thing anyone can do. Do you agree?
I agree. And obviously, we all know that with social media, that just become extremely prevalent. That we are always comparing. And I think, so, you know, one of the biggest things that we end up then having to do is we have to, and it's extremely difficult. Like, I'm not as well versed in philosophy, I think, as you are, Gareth, but there's this idea about mimetic desires from, I think it's René Girard. And it just says that everything that we think we want is actually a consequence of seeing other people wanting those things. And what I think is that it's so difficult to get absolutely clear on what it is that we want for ourselves.
Yeah.
Without being influenced by those around us. Like, you think you want this kind of a life, or you think you want to achieve this kind of success, and when you really reflect on it and like you can really remove all the attachments from wanting to please others or wanting to appear in certain circles, then you start realizing, oh, actually, I don't want that. And I think the pandemic has actually been a good cleanser in that way, that it's made us rethink in many ways who we want to be, what we want to accomplish with our lives, without necessarily reflecting on what other people have thought. And maybe even that's partly because other people's ambitions have also changed. I was speaking to this entrepreneur the other day, hugely successful business. She was like, all I want to do is just sit at home and garden. Like, I don't want to like be at my business anymore. Her ambitions have completely shifted. And like, if you were someone modeling your ambitions on her ambitions, then your ambitions are probably also shifting.
But you'd be screwed.
But we need to be then spending a lot of time making sure that what we want and who we are is not attached to what other people want and who other people want to be, which is an extremely difficult thing to do. It takes a lot of time.
Listen, congratulations.
It's marketing, guys.
It is. So much of everything we do is marketing. It's called, the book is called Dangerous. It is by Eric Kruger. You can get it at good bookstores, or you can get it online in digital format. Be the threat to your threats. If you like this conversation, you'll probably like all of the very good lessons that Eric gives, as well as the work that you can do, because there's actual step-by-step stuff you can do. You know, a lot of these books, it's all philosophy and you don't know how to implement it. So here's a way to execute on these ideas. And I can only say well done, Eric. It's good to see you again.
Yeah, thank you, Lebang, Gareth. Great to be here this morning.
Nice to have you on the show. And we will see everybody tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. bright and early, because that's what we have to do. We have to wake up and get shit done. And then, of course, Thursday is a public holiday, so tomorrow is almost like a mini Friday. We'll see you tomorrow. Cheers, everybody. Bye-bye.
Ciao. CliffCentral.com